My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of My Classic Album, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, thank you very much for joining me for another episode of the show, one that I know that a lot of people have been looking forward to over the last few weeks. Terry DeWitt, vocalist for the fantastic American band Deep Fall, will be joining me in just a little bit to chat about Alice in Chains' second studio album, Dirt. I know it's one, as I've said, that's been highly anticipated. We ran a poll on the stories on our social media channels. So if you're not already a member following any of the social media channels, absolutely take the time to do so. Search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook and like the page or follow the page My Classic Album Podcast over on Instagram or at @MCA_podcast on Twitter. We ran a little bit of a poll as to the album that we're doing over the next few weeks, the people we're the most looking forward to hearing about. And Dirt won quite convincingly. You know, I think Fallen by Evanescence, that we're going to be doing in about a month's time, that also really kind of gave it a bit of run for its money. But people are just really excited to hear us talk about this album. And it's a really powerful album. It's very dark. It's got a lot of dark themes and images within it. But it is just a fantastic album. And about time that we did some more grunge. You know, we have done a few grunge albums over the years on My Classic Album. We've explored a couple of Nirvana albums. We did Soundgarden, Super Unknown last year. But, you know, Alice in Chains were a band that I've been waiting for a while. And I thought, will it be Dirt? Will it be Facelift? Dirt was the one that got the nod. So my chat with Terry is coming up in just a little bit. I alluded to one there, but we do have some really great and more modern classic albums coming up on the podcast in the next few weeks. And after this episode with Terry from Deep Fall is all said and done, we're going to be turning our focus to another band across the next two episodes of My Classic Album. So you may know Robbie J. Fonts as the lead singer of Stuck Mojo. You may know Vicky Sirakis as the lead vocalist of The Agonist. Put them together, husband and wife duo, and they have formed a band that I'm really, really excited about in Sixth Sense. Really great kind of new metal vibes, but done in a way that's really kind of modern. You know, Sixth Sense are really a band to watch, and I was really excited to be able to get the opportunity to speak to both of them about their classic album. So in a couple of weeks' time, Robbie will be coming on the show to talk about Slipknot's debut album, their self-titled, from 1999, and Vicky will be coming on to talk about Evanescence's debut album from 2003, which is Fallen. Fallen particularly, a really important album for me when I was kind of in my teenage years. It's one that I really resonated with. And of course, Slipknot, you know, I mean, Slipknot, they're such a huge band now, so really fun to be able to go back and explore that initial album on the eve of their new album coming out as well. I don't know if people have seen that, but they've got a new album coming out in September. So just before that comes out, it's the opportunity for us to go back and kind of discuss where it all began. And it's an amazing story. So those episodes are coming up throughout August and September here on My Classic Album. So just make sure, you know, to keep up with all the episodes and anything to do with My Classic Album, follow those social media channels, as I said, and get yourself over to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. But before we dive in to today's episode, I want to take a moment to talk about, you know, the musical that's kind of sweeping the world as we speak at the moment, and one that we've talked about on the show in the past. Bat to Hell, the musical, is currently on a tour of kind of the UK and Ireland. Now, what's fantastic about that is that I was lucky enough way back in season one in 2017 to chat with a wonderful lady called Jacqueline Dillon, who was a confidant, good friend of Jim Steinman, who wrote the initial Bat Outta Hell album. You know, all of these songs that you know by Meatloaf, Bonnie Tyler, Pandora's Box, you name it. You know, Jim was very much the visionary of all of that. And To give you a bit of context, we were doing an episode celebrating 40 years of Bat Outta Hell. We're now up to 45 years of the album, which is absolutely crazy to think. And anyone who listens to the show will know that Bat Outta Hell is my classic album. So we wanted to do that justice. We wanted to really kind of celebrate the 40th anniversary of that album. And Jacqueline came on and we had a really fantastic conversation, not only about Bat Outta Hell, but Meatloaf, Jim Steinman, the musical. It brought everything full circle because these songs were originally meant to be part of a musical, you know, rather than a studio album. And Jacqueline had been saying to me for years, we've stayed in touch for years after that conversation, please tell me when you want to see the musical, I'll get you tickets. You can go along, you can check it out. And the timing just wasn't great because we just had our daughter Ellie, so we couldn't really leave her alone, and then obviously COVID hit, and there's just been loads of reasons why it didn't happen. But then, of course, now, you know, things are starting to calm down, my daughter's a bit older, and the musical's on a UK tour. So Bat Outta Hell came to Newcastle towards the end of July and the beginning of August, and Jacqueline managed to secure myself, my wife, and my in-laws tickets to go and see the show. Now, this is something that I'd been really kind of building up in my mind for the last 5 years, that, you know, I really wanted to see this musical. In a weird way, the songs being performed in the way that perhaps they initially been intended, you know, as a musical, kind of telling a story and a plot. I'm sure many people listen to the podcast and have seen the musical already. If you haven't, I'd say regardless of whether you're a Meatloaf fan or not, I would absolutely recommend you going to check it out. It's, you know, if you're into musicals, if you're into rock, if you're into Jim Steinman, there's something for everybody in this. And it was such a strange experience for me in that, you know, I've been to theatre before, I've been to gigs before, I've seen Meatloaf a few times, you know, for me it was quite an emotional experience, which it caught me off guard. It's not something I was really expecting. The plot is absolutely bonkers in the way that Jim Steinman stuff is. You know, there's something for everybody. I guess if you're easily offended, maybe stay away from it. It's a show that isn't for the faint-hearted in that sense, but it's very much in the spirit of Jim Steinman and Meatloaf and all of that fantastic music. And I found myself on a few occasions just kind of welling up, and I was kind of reflecting on that afterwards. And I think it's because these songs have been so important to me over the years, you know, particularly from that first Bat Outta Hell album, but also from Bat Outta Hell 2, Bat Outta Hell 3, Dead Ringer, Braver Than We Are, you know, to name a few. Bad for Good, Jim Steinman's solo album, you know. So to hear these songs kind of on the stage and it kind of going through a plot which is loosely based on Peter Pan, because Jim Steinman was always kind of fascinated with the story of Peter Pan. So it's very much woven into the Bat Outta Hell story. It was just an amazing, amazing spectacle. And, you know, to think that a powerhouse like Meatloaf sang the majority of these songs first, you know, it takes a very special cast to be able to make those songs work and to be able to do them justice. And I think that everyone that I saw on the show in Newcastle, which was July the 30th. So if anyone was there on July the 30th for the evening performance, I was there too. Absolutely just a phenomenal, phenomenal performance. I would thoroughly recommend going to see Bat Outta Hell if it's coming to your town. It's still touring all over the UK. I think there might be a US tour going at the moment, but I think it's the kind of musical that's just going to run for years and years, especially now that Jim and Meat are no longer with us. I think it's the perfect tribute to them. So if, you know, if you've got Bat Outta Hell sitting in your record collection, I would thoroughly recommend going to check out the musical. It's absolutely fantastic. And you'll probably discover a few Jim Steinman and Meatloaf songs that maybe you hadn't heard before. So yeah, absolutely, totally go and check it out. But let's get down to business. My special guest today is the fantastic Terry DeWitt from the fantastic band Deep Fall. Before we get to my chat with Terry, which is all about Alice in Chains' second album, here are the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Dirt. Dirt is the second studio album from American grunge rock band Alice in Chains. Following the mainstream success of their debut album Facelift, Alice in Chains reconvened with producer Dave Jordan to record its follow-up. Taking their initial steps into the rock star life, the band and vocalist Lynn Staley in particular were struggling with drug and alcohol addiction, leading to an album much darker and nihilistic than its predecessor. Dirt saw its release on Columbia Records on September the 29th, 1992. For an album with such dark subject matter, Dirt boasted a huge amount of hit singles, with 5 tracks charting on the US mainstream rock chart. Album closer Wood reached number 24 and mirrored its success in the UK at number 26. Then Bones and Angry Chair both secured top 40 success on both sides of the Atlantic, but it was the deeply personal Rooster that transcended the album, reaching number 7 in the US. Down in a Hole capitalised on Rooster's success, marking the second top 10 single for the band, reaching number 10. The success of Dirt singles, when grunge was arguably at its peak, saw Alice in Chains secure their first top 10 album, with Dirt reaching number 6 on the Billboard 200. While its number 42 charting on the UK singles chart was enough to secure gold certification, Dirt would ultimately certify 4 times platinum in the United States, with the album charting across the world in countries including Australia, Germany, and Sweden. Critically acclaimed from release, Dirt is regarded as one of the most important albums of the grunge movement and a true chronicle of addiction and struggle. Voted as Kerrang's Critics' Choice Album of the Year in 1992, its acclaim has only grown, with Kerrang naming Dirt the 39th greatest rock album in 2006, and Classic Rock magazine placing it number 50 in their 100 greatest rock albums of all time in 2001. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Dirt, and I have here with me a very special guest who chose the album to talk about today on My Classic Album. From Deep Fall, this is Terry DeWitt. How's it going?
Hey, how's it going, man? Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, just, you know, obviously, as we always do when we're kickstarting here, why have you chosen Dirt to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Well, for me, Dirt, Alice in Chains in general is just one of the moments in my life where I knew music was that path for me, for sure. So, it means a lot to me, that record.
I mean, thinking of it like that, you know, what are your memories of hearing it for the first time? So obviously we're saying it means a lot. Like, what are those early memories of discovering this album and kind of playing it over and over?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I was younger, like I would say middle school, I grew up liking Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder. And I have to tell you the kind of the story to get there. Sorry, but...
Oh, totally. Go for it.
You know what I mean? So... But, you know, I grew up in kind of a strict household where you couldn't listen to certain things. So I got into gospel music and, like I said, Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder. And then as I got a little bit older, probably about 13, 14, you know, started hanging out with different people and got into Pink Floyd, Metallica, and started getting into hard rock. But my CDs were always taken away. But I remember being, going through that kind of stuff, you know, liking stuff in high school. And I remember just getting out of high school. I was about 19 years old. And I heard, like, songs on the radio, of course, you know, things like that. But never, I liked it, I heard it, but you know, you're just kind of going on with things. But I remember at a buddy's house, we were sitting down, and this record was on. I was just sitting there, and I'm hearing these song after song after song after song, and I'm just like, oh my gosh. And that's where I really took a deep dive into Dirt and what it meant to, like, that whole record, you know, the struggles. That was kind of one of those moments in the band where it was the end after that, kind of, in a way. So, But for me personally, just hearing those songs, the pain, the agony, you just hear it all, you know. It's emotional, and it always struck me the way he writes, all that kind of, I'm a huge Layne Staley and Chris Cornell fan, and I just love the pain and agony, you know what I mean? It's just, It's all believable, and it just hit me right in the heart. So I'll never forget listening to that for the first time, for sure.
And that's the definition of, like, if you know where you were when you heard it for the first time, like, that it's blatantly your classic album.
My buddy Sean's house, chilling, heard it, like, whoa, you know?
And I mean, so in the last couple of years, we've got stuck into some of the great grunge albums. So we did Super Unknown by Soundgarden last year. We've done both Bleach and Nevermind by Nirvana. How important do you think Alice in Chains were in the development of that kind of Seattle grunge scene?
I think massively. I think they're kind of the most unique, you know what I mean? And they're always my favorite grunge band, personally. I mean, I love all the other ones, too, don't get me wrong, and they're amazing, but there's just something about Alice in Chains that's different, you know? There's just something about them that's different. All the harmonies, and it's just a lot of depth to it as well, and I don't know. It's just, to me, it's just stands out different. And I think it's very important as a whole, because there's a lot of emulation of Layne, and, you know, kind of that writing has took a whole nother turn, you know, and it's been, I think it's cool to see that. It just impacted music no matter what. It's undeniable is what it is.
Yeah. So. And I think it's funny if we're talking about that kind of, they get called, you know, obviously thrash metal have their big four, and so do grunge, you know. Yep. So, you know, we've got Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, throw Pearl Jam in there as well. There's that really kind of established sound, I guess. But what I always appreciated about Alice in Chains was kind of that very, very strong heavy metal influence.
Absolutely.
Maybe they're a little bit with Soundgarden, but not so much with Nirvana and Pearl Jam that I could hear. I mean, how much do you feel that helped Alice in Chains stand out against all these other great bands that we're talking about?
Yeah, they're a riffing machine. They're riff machines, Jerry Cantrell, but it's the tones. It's the sound of Alice in Chains. That's what I always explained it to. Yes, the metal influence for sure, but I think all the weird sounds. It's kind of like when you listen to Pink Floyd for the first time. There's just stuff that sounds different that you weren't used to hearing. And I think Alice in Chains is like the Pink Floyd of grunge, I guess. It's kind of like my, because it's just different. It takes you to different places, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Dirt was Alice in Chains' second album.
Yep. So that Facelift. Yeah. Facelift was one, I believe. Yep. Loved that record too. Well, that was like in 87, right? Or something. Like, I know it was
1990, I've got here. So their debut, 1990, Facelift. Came out,
okay. So, yeah, like at that time, I was only seven. Do you know what I mean? So that stuff was kind of, I was young. And then when I got into high school, you know, like 1920-ish, that's, you know, and it's crazy because what songs are off of Facelift that were on the radio?
I'd say Man in the Box was probably the main one.
Well, Man in the Box, that's the big the smash. And then what else?
Yeah, I mean, let's have a look.
Yeah, we got to do it, man.
Let's cheat.
This is fun. We can cheat.
We cheat. Right. Wikipedia is our friend.
We're good at it. I'm just kidding, man.
So let's see. So yeah, so we had Man in the Box and Sea of Sorrow.
Yep. And then you go to the album that we're talking about right now. And I there's a huge difference. The writing's just, Dirt, to just hit that the writing is incredible. There's so many amazing songs, man. Like, you just look back on it now that I'm older and you appreciate it. Because when you're a young kid, you know, you're just loving this stuff because it's dope. Can we swear on here? Like, shit?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
I thought I heard it, but I just want to make sure.
Yeah, no worries.
Try to be respectful, you know what I mean? But, you know, when you're a kid, you're just listening to these songs and you're in that moment because you're living your life at that time. And then when you get older, you look back on some of this with the knowledge you've gained just about life and people and things like that. And just read the lyrics and you can feel the emotion. It's like, holy cow, this is crazy, you know?
And I think it's funny because if you think about the almost kind of the condensed version of music history, it's like Smells Like Teen Spirit came out and grunge exploded. But I don't think that's a very kind of accurate representation of what happened, really. And I think when you look at it, I mean, I've got a quote here from Metal Hammer that says, within 18 months, Alice in Chains had leapfrogged the likes of Soundgarden and Nirvana to become grunge's first superstars. With their debut album, Facelift, they became the first band from the Seattle scene to sell 500,000 records, opening the door for everyone to follow. So it feels like Facelift is the beginning of that. Why do you think that it was that album rather than Bleach, for example, which again, you know, is a really celebrated album? Why do you think it was Facelift rather than Bleach that kind of brought grunge into that mainstream and was the first one to break the charts?
Well, I definitely think that's where the metal influence comes in as well, you know, because it just kind of, it just morphed into something different with that. It's just different. Let's be real, you know? I love Pearl Jam, but I'll take Alice in Chains over Pearl Jam. You know what I mean? Like, musically, like, I don't know. It's just something about the sounds for me, personally, obviously. Pearl Jam people are just going to be hating on me right now. I'm just kidding. But the sound was so different from anything else. And the metal influence, a little harder. I think that's just why. And Facelift was a great record. It was so different than anything I've ever heard. It's just so eerie and dark, and, you know, all the other stuff was too in its own way, but this stuff is way darker and more eerie. It's just, it went down a different tunnel that people, I don't think, heard, really. There's nobody that sounds like Alice in Chains. I mean, there's just not, there's people now that do, that try to, but I'm saying back then there wasn't that at all. It kind of had more of the 80s, like you said, more of the 80s influence a little bit in some of the other stuff, but yeah, it's just a different thing. It's cool getting to see it, you know? Evolve.
Yeah. And I think if you think about those bands that were massive at the time, obviously Guns N' Roses were probably the biggest band in the world at that point. You know what I mean? Def Leppard. Def Leppard had released Hysteria. I guess Alice in Chains coming along with something that was very different was probably a very kind of welcome, like a welcome presence at the time.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I think it's important. You know, music is going to change. You go through them periods. Like, even look at the early 2000s of rock and, you know, just the transitions that have been made, you know, it's inevitable. People change, kids are growing up, they listen to different things. You know, it's crazy, kind of the ride you go on, and then it all kind of recycles back. So,
I mean, by the time we get to the Dirt Sessions, things have changed for the band quite a bit. So they've got this top 40 album under their belt. They've been touring with the likes of Van Halen and Extreme. They've seen kind of the other side of fame. And producer Dave Jordan told Music Radar that back in 1990, he said they did some drinking, but there were no drugs. It was funny. They wanted to know where the strip clubs in LA were. We were driving down Hollywood Boulevard, so I pointed to one called the Tropicana. But by the time Dirt was being tracked, things had changed. They were a big established band and the vibe was different. They were getting jaded. Lane told me he didn't like being famous. He told me flat out, people look at you like a piece of merchandise. And you'd said, obviously, there is quite a change between these two albums. You know, what is it? What are the noticeable changes between what we hear on Facelift and then what we would then go on to hear on Dirt?
I think for me, it's just the writing. I think you could kind of tell with Facelift. I mean, there's amazing songs on there, but like songwriting, you know, it just seemed like the melodies were stronger. Everything was stronger for the Dirt record for me. That was the noticeable changes, is just seasoned musicians already having one under their belt. And you could kind of see the next steps with Dirt, in my opinion. It just seemed like everything kind of came together for that, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, that's interesting you should say that, because that ties in quite nicely to my next question. Because I guess, as Dave alluded to there, during these tours with Van Halen and such, the band had discovered hard drugs between the production of the two albums. And obviously, and that's a huge theme running through this album. And Lane Staley is unflinchingly honest about his heroin addiction throughout this. And in the words of Medium, they say he decided to tackle this in his lyrics without being ready to quit. So this isn't coming from a perspective of someone who has been, well, he had been to rehab, but
yes,
someone who'd been to rehab and kind of sort of tidied himself up and all this sort of stuff. This is someone who's very much in the throes of addiction in these songs that we're hearing about. You know, and you said, obviously, the songwriting is a huge part of what makes this album what it is.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to people in a way too, because, you know, addiction, there's a lot of people. I struggled with things when I was younger, and you go through life, and when you experience pain and agony and addiction and you experience those things in life and you just experience life in general, you can kind of understand where Lane's coming from in a way where it's like, I think there's a lot of people like that, you know, that have a hard time with themselves or a hard time with life. And it's tough, man. Art's an outlet for a lot of people. And sometimes you can't get out of your own head. It just seems like he was that kind of guy, you know. If you read about him, you know, everybody said he was a very gracious person, nice person, helpful. I think he had Jerry Cantrell stay with him when he first went to LA, I believe, or Seattle, when he was there. I think he stayed with Lane, and you know what I mean? You just hear that he was a great guy and funny, and you know, but people behind closed doors are dealing with things, you know, and that's just the way to get it out, you know. It's just, sorry, I just rambled on, but I hope what I said makes sense. Sometimes I just start going, dude, you know.
No, that's what my classic album's all about. It's all good. Yeah. I think as well, though, you know, when you think about some of those greatest albums of all time, you know be it not necessarily around addiction, but like you said, just kind of the pain and suffering that we can go through in life, and then how certain artists can channel that into amazing music, which is obviously a great example that we're talking about today.
Yeah, and plus addiction is such a broad thing. I know that heroin obviously is what he's discussing, or you know, all the stuff that they did at that time, but you know, addiction can be food, it can be gambling, it can be a lot of things, you know, and it's really something that everybody deals with at some point probably in their life, you know what I mean? So it speaks to just so many people on that kind of level, and I think that kind of music's important, you know.
And I mean, it wasn't only Lane who was using at the time.
Jerry
Cantrell. Yeah. I mean, he told Consequence, he says, we all partied. So to point the finger at Lane, might as well point the finger at all of us. Unfortunately, he's the lead singer.
Yeah.
In the lyrical context of what he was writing, he was putting it out there. I always thought that was very brave of him. And I always stood behind that. Which I think that's important to say, like, you know, very often with certain band dynamics, it is kind of the lead singer who is kind of the... It can also be a vanity project for them at times, or they're kind of the conceptual leader of the band. But this feels like a true group statement rather than just a vanity project for Lane Staley, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah. And I think, too, like the authenticity of the band as people, you know? I like that about Alice in Chains a lot as well. They didn't waver from who they were as people. They just kind of owned it, which I think people should do more of. So I like seeing that a lot. Yeah. I know, but it's just like... It's a good thing.
And I guess what that creates, this dynamic within the album, which I think is fascinating, that, you know, obviously you would never want, you know, anyone to be going through that kind of misery just for the pleasure of an amazing album coming out. But it also means that there's this dynamic of drugs being detrimental to the album, but also kind of essential to the themes and sounds of it at the same time, which is a really interesting juxtaposition, because it's kind of like, obviously, ideally, I'm sure even he wouldn't want to have had this addiction, but without it, we wouldn't have the album that we're talking about today, certainly not in the form that we're talking about it today.
Yeah. I think music's an addiction. It's like doing well, just writing songs, like the song, like the Revolution song that we have right now out. Like you're writing a song about things that are deep, and you have to kind of go at it that way, you know? I think that's what's important is people ask, you know, hey, why are you getting into music? Why do you do these things? And it's if you can affect somebody's life in a positive way and write songs that get through to people. I think that's, if you can't do that, you're missing the ball, you know?
I mean, it seems like that kind of dynamic did cause some disagreements in the studio. So Medium explained that the producer, Jordan, and Staley butted heads throughout the recording because of his drug use. The singer was in and out of rehab throughout the year, but resumed using heroin while making the album. As a producer, Jordan knew he had a job to do and didn't care if Staley liked him or not. And again, remember, this was the guy who was also producing Facelift, so he's seen this massive change in dynamic from kind of recording this band's debut album to then working with them when they're more established. That must have been a really difficult tightrope for him to walk, and such a challenge for him to think, how am I gonna balance all this and get the best possible album out of it at the end of it?
Well, he sure as hell did, and it's incredible. I mean, that's just crazy. You know, you hear stories like just, you know, working with other people, and you hear stories about things, and it's pretty, I can't imagine dealing with that situation the way those guys were at that time and trying to corral. What do they say? It's like corralling cats or something.
You know? Yeah. I think I'd read something about that Lane kind of decorated the booth with a dead puppy in a jar and like just really bizarre things. But I think, you know, and obviously I imagine a lot of people would probably recoil at that little factoid, you know, but at the same time, I think that's him with that process of, you know, obviously we'll get into the songs, we'll get into kind of the themes of it, but he obviously needed to be in a certain place in order to even approach it, let alone record it.
Well, that's the thing. And that's what I mean by an addiction. He kind of has two of them, because you do the heroin to write the music, and then do you think you need the heroin to write the music, and you kind of get trapped in that mental space. And I think he was there, you know, all the time, where you feel like you got to do one to be able to do the other. And, you know, there's, you know, you always have that self-doubt and anxiety. It's just, it's the kind of person he was, I feel, you know what I mean? So it's just, I don't know. Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, drummer Sean Kinney, he reflected on the band's relationship with drugs in the book Grunge is Dead. And he said, it's all right there. It's laid out, explained exactly what we were doing, what we were going through. It sounds like what was echoing in our heads at that time. From then on, some of us continued further down in that direction and some of us didn't. That's a tough album for me. People are like, that's your greatest record. It's bittersweet. And I guess that's a really interesting point, you know, for Sean and Jerry, who are still around, and you know, obviously they'll be very proud of that album and the music they've produced. But, you know, do you think that maybe for Sean in particular, do you think that it's maybe kind of too raw of an album in terms of what it brings up to him?
I mean, I'm sure. I can't imagine how he must feel about all of it, you know. I can't imagine losing a brother or somebody you love and just, you know, and hearing their voice and you miss the person, but you know they're in pain. I can't imagine it's easy for him at all. I mean, it'd be hard for anybody, I think.
I mean, alongside all of this, the production of the album actually coincides with a really significant event in US history, which I do think is relevant, and I'll explain why in a minute.
Yep.
On April 29th, 1992, a jury acquitted four officers of assault and acquitted three of the four of using excessive force on Rodney King. So the verdict leads to mass rioting across LA for 6 days, which happens to be where Dirt was being tracked at the time. I mean, before we, obviously, I've got a quote from Jerry talking about his experience of that, actually. But before we link back to that, because I mean, obviously, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm from the UK. I'm aware of this kind of moment in history. But I guess being outside of the US, the significance of that, obviously, I understand the political and racial significance of that. But I wasn't there. I didn't experience it. Do you have any memories of that scene and that unfolded in the news and the mood in the country at the time? Anything like that?
I mean, I was a kid. I was 10. So I definitely remember being a kid and seeing it on TV and not understanding why that was happening, because I was like, I thought they were supposed to help people, you know, because you're a kid. You're just like, what's going on? You know, now, what did this person do? And I remember conversations around me about it, and definitely remember seeing it. But I, as far as like the climate when you're a kid, you know what I mean? It's not like I remember how people were at that time, you know. I just remember being a kid, but I just remember it being very impactful, and it was a horrible thing, you know. It's horrible to see that, and it definitely forever changed a lot of things too, as it should.
I mean absolutely. I mean Jerry he recalls of that experience. So as I said, you know, the band were in LA as this was happening.
I can't imagine.
They say, we came down to LA, started tracking the record, and the Rodney King verdict came down. The fucking town went up in flames. We were staying at the Oakswood in Venice, so we had to come from Studio City to Venice while the whole city's in a riot. We called up Tom Araya from Slayer, and we went out to the desert and hung out there for a while till the shit cooled down. We had to postpone until the riots chilled out. That's a moment I'll never forget, tied to that record. And I guess for me, it'd be one thing for me to say, oh, this happened while they were recording the record, there must be a link. But when Jerry remembers that so vividly and he's talking about it kind of after the fact, you know, you've got to think that that political climate and being at the epicenter of all of that, it must have played a role in what we hear, at least sonically on the album.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine like being down there in that, you know. I mean, just being what they must have experienced with just the people in the area and the whole mood and everything. It had to be nuts. And then on top of the addiction, and I mean, it's just everything is on fire. It's kind of like now.
Yeah.
it's weird how things cycle through. You know, we're talking about a record, and you know, we're going through very similar things now, and it's just nobody seems to learn shit, do they?
It's funny. I was thinking the same, because it often comes up sometimes the themes that we're talking about with these albums, and then it will either really relate to something that's going on or just show that, like you said, that things don't seem to change.
It's just people, you know. If you have people that can't care about others or be open-minded and have conversations, the only way you ever get anywhere is to have conversations about things, you know, and you have to be able to be open-minded and not love everything somebody has to say, but talk about it in a respectful manner. And I think that stuff, I just wish we could do that more, you know, probably get a lot more done that way.
So, I mean, Dirt would ultimately, as he had said, in a weird way, it's kind of the end, certainly for the classic Alice in Chains lineup. So bassist Mike Starr would leave the band during the tour for the album. Ultimately, Lane and Mike would lose their lives to drugs in 2002 and 2011, respectively. I mean, what kind of legacy do you think, if we're saying that Dirt is kind of, well, it is, it's that kind of final hurrah for that classic lineup. What kind of legacy is that to leave behind for Lane and Mike in particular?
I mean, it's a great legacy. It's something that's going to live on forever. So, you know, they should be, and their family should be proud of what they've done. And it sucks, you know, how music is made sometimes and how people get out of them what they get out of them. But you just, you know, you kind of understand the pain and agony. And the legacy is, again, undeniable. The dude, they're amazing. They're incredible at what they did. And, you know, sucks they're gone, but they'll live on forever for sure.
So, I mean, we're about to go track by track in a moment. I mean, yeah. Upon its release, Dirt reached number 6 on the US Billboard 200. Why do you think that Dirt has resonated in the way it did? Why do you think that is?
I think it's just the sound of Alice in Chains again. I think there's just nobody that sounds like Alice in Chains. They're just such a unique band. And, you know, I think that Pearl Jam's amazing and Nirvana's amazing. But the 10 album, you know, other than that, from Pearl Jam, you know, I don't know. I think Alice in Chains is just such a different breed, you know, with the music and how dark it was. And I just think that's why. I don't know. It's just tough because they're all great in their own way, but I'm going to fight for this one.
Absolutely.
I'll argue anybody about it. It's fine. That thing I said earlier about talking about things, I take that back.
So like I say, we'll dive in, we'll go track by track now, and I'll just preface this by saying that different editions of the album have a slightly revised track order, so some of these tracks are moved about on other editions. The order I'm going for, I think, is the most established order. It was on both Apple Music and Wikipedia, so the two reliable sources. So like I say, if your copy of the album, anyone listening, if it's in a slightly different order, like there are different versions floating around.
I have no papers next to me because I know every song.
Well, that's all good. Let's go. So we'll start with Them Bones. So our opening track, written by Jerry Cantrell, as many of them are on the album. Dead End Follies say Dirt's ferocious opening track. Them Bones is a statement of intent, featuring Jerry Cantrell's walloping guitar riff and hollow, sarcastic lyrics about confronting mortality. It's perhaps the heaviest song in their entire discography. I mean, how does Them Bones kick off the album for you?
Like a right hook in your face, like it should. Yeah. I love it, man. The ahs and everything, it's great.
I mean, in an interview with Rip Magazine at the time, Jerry said, Them Bones is pretty cut and dry. It's a little sarcastic, but it's pretty much about dealing with your mortality in life. Everybody's going to die sometime. Instead of being afraid of it, that's the way it is. So enjoy the time you've got. Death freaks me out. I think it freaks a lot of people out. It's the end of life, depending on your views. It's a pretty scary thing. And that's something I can really relate to. So I struggle quite a bit with death anxiety. Like, it's something that I have to not think about it too much, or it really, I can get down the rabbit hole and really freak myself out. Yet, my creative outlet are right. I'm writing my first novel at the moment, and one of the main themes is like death and life after death. So that's obviously me trying to process that, perhaps in the same way that, that Jerry was trying to process his death anxiety with them bones, perhaps.
Absolutely. And it's powerful because it's something, again, that everybody fears and thinks about. And it's, you know, it's just things you don't maybe talk about all the time, but behind closed doors, these things go through your head all the time, you know, for sure. I worry about it too, man. You know, like you're sitting around, it's like, I have, you know, married and have a kid, and you think about those things, it just cross your mind sometimes, and you try to like, all right, I don't want to be thinking about this, but sometimes it just slaps you right in the face.
Yeah,
for sure.
It does. I mean, obviously, a lot of people, obviously, when we get to kind of side two, many of those songs are more about kind of heroin and drugs and stuff, the things yes. we've discussed. But I think a lot of people would kind of just sort of dismiss this album as being all about that, which I think this is an example of the of how it isn't. Do you think that death is perhaps another theme that's kind of visited throughout the album?
Absolutely. I think the inevitability of death is something that is on this record. And I think that, you know, just listening to songs and like you said, sonically and everything and the lyrics, you know, he knows it's coming. I mean, really. So they all knew it was coming. I promise. Cause it's just, you see this stuff and you know, there's not going to be a great ending to it, you know? So he talks about that, you know, as we go on, we'll get into that too, because I know that that's going to come up.
A lot's made of the change in time signature in this song, with the verses being 7-8 and then the chorus going into 4-4. Jerry told Guitar World, off-time stuff's just more exciting. It takes people by surprise when you shift gears like that before they even know what the hell hit them. It's also effective when you slow something down and then slam them into the dash. A lot of Alice stuff is written that way. Them Bones is a great off-time song. Is that something that you think is a bit of a trademark of theirs? That, you know, that they're not afraid to kind of jump around time signatures and just make things a bit more interesting?
Yeah, and I just think where they take you with even octaves and sonically, guitar sounds, and how it's all mixed, you know, how it all sounds. It's just so amazing and so different. You know,
so I mean, Dead End Follies, and they've written a review of the album, and I'll probably reference it quite a lot through our chat. They continue their praise and they say, Them Bones accomplishes in two minutes and a half what most bands can't accomplish in their entire career, being dark enough to create a sense of genuine unease for the listener. It's considered an Alice in Chains classic, but it's also an iconic rock and roll moment. I guess my question was going to be, do you agree with that statement? But I can hear already that you're very much behind that one.
It is. It's just different. There's nothing like it. and that's what makes it so great. You know, when you could do something that hasn't been done before, that's great.
So we'll move on to Damn That River. I mean, Classic Rock Review say the track, Damn That River, is a steady and riff driven with harmonized vocals during the verses and Staley alone during choruses. It contains a decent lead after second verse before reaching an abrupt ending. I mean, after that fan favorite, Them Bones, that we were talking about, how does Damn That River fare in kind of continuing that momentum? Again, thinking about you perhaps kind of sitting, just hearing track after track for the first time as you're listening.
Well, as a singer, you hear Lane and what he's doing. And, you know, right when he comes in again, it's high kind of soaring notes. You know, it's just with all the harmonies on it, just grabs your ear right away. I love the verses to that song, you know. I think that's what gets you right away in is just that opening verse to that one. It's great. Coming out of Them Bones into that verse, into the next song is awesome.
One of my favorite facts I've found in the whole time I've done my classic album here. So it says, the 1999 Alice in Chains box set Music Bank documents what this song's about. So apparently Jerry and Sean got into a big fight during production, and that Sean apparently broke a coffee table over Jerry's head. That just the whole image of that just blows my mind.
In the WWE,
exactly. In response, Jerry wrote this song, and I can't find out because I find that so fascinating, and I wanted to know more about that. I couldn't find anything else. Is that have you heard anything about that, or is that anything that Jerry's?
I have not.
Such a shame.
No, I have not heard that at all, man.
I think
that's cool though. That's the stuff. I love it, though, because who knows, right?
I know. And I think, I mean, even, like, I mean, this is a quote from Genius. So they say that the song's a metaphor for revenge, with the inability to dam the river, in their opinion, symbolizing the uncontrolled bleeding from Cantrell's head. which I guess if he was, to be fair, if you've been hit with a coffee table, I imagine that probably is going to do a bit of damage.
That will probably leave a mark.
Yeah. And I just, I mean, you know what it is? It's like, you know, I've admired Jerry Cantrell for a long time and I've often thought if I ever met him, what question would I ask him? I think I know the question now. I think I would have to ask him about this incident because it just fascinates me really. I wonder what led to that. And what, you know, was it perhaps drug induced or was it creative differences or what was it that led to kind of such an intense confrontation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows, man? But it makes sense. Like, it could be true.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Dead End Follies, again, they interpret Damn That River as a gorgeous, tormented, natural metaphor about the bitter ending to a friendship and the feeling of powerlessness of seeing someone inexplicably turn on you. So perhaps there is something to that story. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's cool. Yeah. I mean, that's cool to know. I had no idea.
Yeah. So we'll move on to Rain When I Die. So Classic Rock Review save this one. Rain When I Die has a bass beginning, odd rhythm, doomy guitars during a long intro before breaks into a repetitive guitar riff, but with some of the best sounding guitars on the album. I mean, what do you thought? Obviously, we've said sonically we think that the album sounds fantastic. Would you say that Rain When I Die, from a guitar perspective, is perhaps a highlight of the album?
I don't know. I'm not a guitar player and I'm not even going to. I would say probably not, would be my opinion.
Yeah.
But I always love this song. This is actually one of my favorite songs, believe it or not. Because I love the Lane's power chorus on this song a lot. I mean, it's just awesome. And I always remember hearing that and just like sticking to me, you know, and just again going back as you're older. And here we are talking about Rain When I Die and death and going down that path, you know. And it's just, to me, it's a powerful song, and I love the rhythm vocally he sings with. It's just so cool. I always like this song a lot.
I mean, for me, it's funny, you said that you didn't think it was, you know, the guitars particularly. I think for me, what I tend to focus on more is Mike Starr on bass, and that's probably due to the intro. But, you know, for me, it is something of a showcase for him. I mean, bearing in mind, as we said a few minutes ago, this is, you know, his last album with Alice in Chains. What are your thoughts of his performance on Rain When I Die? And to be fair, throughout the album.
I mean, again, everything on this album is amazing. You know, when I listen to music, bass is not like the first thing that I like. It's not like I listen and think like that. But just the driving force, you can feel it, you know, if that makes sense. And I think the bass and drummer on all these songs, there's just, it goes and it's just on an amazing path everywhere, you know. It's kind of what kickstarts everything, you know. And without that foundation, I mean, it's just, it's one of the best records, man. It's just amazing. So all them guys, like a legacy, you know, forever. I mean, everybody was at their A game during this. You know, everyone. And it's just, you can hear it.
I mean, we've talked so much about how many of the songs reference drugs. As I've said, for anyone who's maybe not heard the album, once we get to side two, that's where that really sort of kicks in. I think Rain When I Die is a good example, similar to Them Bones. You know, this isn't an album solely about kind of heroin and drugs. And Jerry simply said in the past that it's a song to a girl. Do you think that it needs these songs that maybe aren't as, I mean, to be fair, you know, death is still a very dark and kind of nihilistic topic for music, but do you think Dirt needs songs like this to kind of to level it out rather than it being kind of an entire album about heroin addiction?
I mean, I don't think so. You know, I don't know. I think people just write songs and people like them or they don't, you know. I think it's just what it is. You know, I think they just wrote the song and it was cool and it meant something to them, and I think that's how these things come up for me, and I think for a lot of people, you know. But yeah, he's probably just, something happened in your life and, you know, you're in that mood or you're going through something and you wrote a song about it, you know. It's cool. It's just life shit, you know. And that's why, if you notice, it's girls, it's drugs, you know, it's tough. It's tough to balance all that shit for them. I mean, we can't imagine being super duper stars and having to deal with all the bullshit and trying to go through the path of figuring out different things. It's got to be very difficult. So the girl probably broke his heart and he was pissed. So we've all been there.
So we're just getting started through our journey of Alice in Chains' second studio album, Dirt, with my special guest Terry DeWitt from Deep Fall. That conversation will continue in just a little bit. And as we've alluded to there, there's some songs that really get into a very dark place about Lane Staley's drug addiction. So, you know, if these are songs or themes or anything that might potentially kind of have an impact, you know, make sure that you're looking after yourself, and you know, making sure that you taking a few minutes. I don't know if you need to, because again, you know, sometimes these classic albums cover some heavy stuff, and there's nothing wrong with kind of pausing the podcast or doing what you need to do and looking after yourself and then coming back. So the rest of my chat with Terry is coming up in just a little bit. But first, let's hear the latest single from Deepfall. This was released earlier this year. The latest single from the band, this is Deepfall with Revolution. Is Down in a Hole. So this was actually the final single released from Dirt. It's one of my favorites on the album. More mellow than what we've heard so far. In the liner notes for Music Bank, the box set we were talking about earlier, Jerry explained that he wrote the song for his then girlfriend Courtney Clark, knowing Down in a Hole is in my top three personally. It's to my longtime love. It's the reality of my life. the path I've chosen, and in a weird way, it kind of foretold where we are right now. It's hard for us to both understand that this life is not conducive to much success with long-term relationships. So that's obviously Jerry's kind of thoughts and what that song brings up for him. What are your thoughts on Down in a Hole?
Well, it's definitely one of my favorite Alice in Chains songs of all time. I mean, I don't know which my favorite would be, but it's in the top, you know, it's up there. It's one of them for sure. And this song, to me, was always about, like, I remember, I didn't even listen to the words when I first heard the song. It was just the melodies. The melodies to the song are incredible. I think it can mean a lot of different things. This one you can kind of take. I know that's what he says, but I think this is one of those where this one kind of can grow some legs and mean different things to a lot of different people. You know what I mean? So I definitely think this is one of those kind of songs.
Jerry was reluctant to share the song with the rest of the band, fearing it was too soft. But when he did, obviously the guys really liked it and they recorded it. There's a complete parallel there to Nothing Else Matters by Metallica that James Hetfield also thought was too soft, didn't think the band would like it. Yeah. They really liked it. Again, there's a couple of parallels there, but they are very different songs kind of outside of that. Does it feel, does this song feel like a departure for Alice in Chains in the same way that Nothing Else Matters was a huge departure for Metallica?
No. I think these songs make Alice in Chains Alice in Chains. If you go see Alice in Chains and they'll go melt your face and then they'll come out and play all this pretty stuff for a while and you're just like, whoa. And I think that is amazing. I want to see a show and I love metal. I love everything. But yeah, there's times I want to go and just go melt some faces and have a good time and listen to metal. But there's times I want to have an experience and go on that emotional roller coaster ride. You know what I mean? And I think that's what all these kind of songs bring. You know, like we talked about them bones and you're going to kind of sing these upbeat songs and hitting this one. This song kind of hits you right in the face and, you know, it can mean so many different things and it's just powerful lyrics, incredible melodies. Yeah, it's awesome.
And I mean, there's also like a beautiful rendition of Down in a Hole recorded during the band's performance on MTV Unplugged in 1996.
Yes.
So for me, it feels like, obviously, whenever bands do this, I always think like, you know, obviously kind of more modern times, I always think like, oh, what songs would be perfect for that treatment? And like, Down in a Hole is like the perfect song to get that MTV Unplugged treatment.
I mean,
what do you think? I'm guessing you've seen that Unplugged performance.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
is this the highlight of it? Are there any other particular parts of that performance that stand out for you?
I mean, I loved him singing Down in a Hole. Anytime I can hear that dude sing, you know, I don't think it was my favorite performance of theirs on that, you know, as far as the song that they did, because they did Sludge Factory on that, and I thought that was amazing. It just sounded incredible acoustic, and I mean, obviously it was amazing, but you could just tell Lane, for me it was kind of sad, to be honest. Like, watching that makes me sad, you know? It's just, you can just see that he's just dying in front of your eyes. You can see it, you know? And I think that being a fan of his, and you kind of go through and you see him when he's younger, and he's a badass rock star, and he just looks so weak and tired, and I don't know. It's just every time I see that thing, it just makes me sad. And I'm just like, oh, I always think of that and him dying, and they always correlate together for me. I don't know why, but it just does. It's just,
I mean, as I'd said at the top of the track by track, there are editions of Dirt where the track list is shut up. Mm-hmm. So obviously we're talking about it as track 4 here. There's some editions where it's right towards the end of the album at track 12. So off the top of your head, do you know what version of Dirt, like for you, does Dirt come quite early in the album, or do the versions you had have it quite late, or?
Dirt was like in the middle.
Do you think that makes, because we talk loads on My Classic Album about kind of the sequencing of an album and kind of what opens the album and what opens side two and stuff. Do you think it makes a difference where this track is in terms of like, your, not necessarily in terms of your overall enjoyment, but the journey that the album takes you on?
Absolutely. I think you'll lose listeners if this is the first track.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Somebody might hear this and be like, yeah. But again, you're opening with them bones and kind of the journey you're going on. You're kind of understanding sonically where they're going, the depth behind the music. So I think it's a great track to be middle, you know? Because by the time you hit this song, you kind of get a taste of what Alice in Chains is. And then wham, you get this one. You're like, whoa. Because it's just different. There's not really anything like it.
Would it feel different if it, because I think, if I remember rightly, like say if that was track 12, then it would be, mm-hmm. the album would end with Down in a Hole and then would, like, Again, does that make the album feel any different, kind of putting those two tracks on the end?
I think it might make it, I mean, it's still going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But it might, it's different now because I'm so used to it. The other, you know what I mean? So I can't be honest about it. It bothers me right now talking about it.
But it's funny because I bet there's some people who'll have that version of it. And for us talking about it now, they'll be like, why are you talking about this now? Like, it's later on. And that's why I thought it was important to bring it up. I'd be interested to know why that was, but never mind. We'll move on to Sick Man, which brings the pace back up. Classic Rock Review single out the song, saying Sick Man features a mechanical drum beat and falls into that groove initially before deprecating into a slow waltz-like break. It repeats this pattern, expands on the slow part during the bridge with some great Brian May-like guitars, which is obviously high praise. It's really like two songs in one, constantly alternating, like the Beatles' I Want You, She's So Heavy. So again, two quite really kind of favorable comparisons there. So, you know, that comparison to Brian May in terms of the guitar sound and then to the Beatles in terms of the song structure, and it kind of sort of alternating between kind of two songs. Would you agree with those comparisons? I can definitely relate to that kind of feeling of it being kind of alternating between two songs.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, definitely hear that. Me personally, on this record, this is one of my least favorite songs. Like if we had to put them in a list. Yeah, I'm just saying, if I had to, like, which one of my favorite songs in order? It's just because I think that this is a song that is just kind of different. It's still cool in its own way, musically, and what they do. But it's just one of those that I listen to it. But this one didn't do as much for me as all the other ones before it, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, it's just kind of one of them songs. I was like, all right, this is cool. Like, there's parts of it that are cool, but it was nothing that I loved or, like, wanted to. I didn't go to that record to listen to that song.
Yeah. And again, obviously, that Dead End Follies that I keep referencing, they love the album, but they have some minor criticism for Sick Man as well. They say a song like Sick Man isn't bad per se, but comes off as straightforward and repetitive compared to other colossal rock anthems on Dirt. So, you know, being straightforward isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I guess, you know, particularly in the 90s when albums were getting, I mean, to be fair, this is 13 tracks. It's not as big as some albums, but, you know, with the birth of the CD, there were tracks that maybe, you know, perhaps this one might not have made it on, you know,
sure,
vinyl edition of the album or something like that.
Everybody has those. and there'll be a lot of people glad to take their worst track and take it.
Yeah, totally.
So it's nothing like that. It's just on this record of incredible songs, it's not my favorite one on
yeah.
it, but it's still something that you're like, if you heard it for the first time ever and you never heard of the band, you're probably like, oh, what else they got? You know, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's just,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, Lane, he was an amazing vocalist in his own right. So when I say this, it's with no suggestion that he's trying to emulate anyone or copy anyone. It was more just that I got a bit of a vibe from the vocals on this one that for some reason, it just kind of, and we've talked about Metallica a few times, it just took me to this kind of early James Hetfield vibe in the vocals,
yeah.
That kind of kill 'em all, ride the lightning kind of.
For anyway. Sure.
Do we know, were Metallica much of an influence on the band? Were they fans of Metallica or that thrash scene?
I would assume they were. I'm not sure how much they talked about it, but I'm assuming they were, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I never looked into that stuff too much. You know, you can kind of hear it,
mm-hmm.
because Metallica is Metallica, and I think they've influenced most everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
to this point.
It's just like, I just assume that, you know what I mean? It's like, it's Metallica, you know what I mean? But definitely, I mean, I think you could say that and be safe.
Yeah. So we'll move on to another highlight of the album, which for many people I'm sure, which is Rooster. So Jerry wrote Rooster for his father, who served in the US Army during the Vietnam War. So again, quite a heavy subject matter. You know, talking to Team Rock in 2006, Jerry said that experience in Vietnam changed him, meaning his dad, forever, and it certainly had an impact on our family. I guess it was a defining moment in my life too. He didn't walk out on us. We left him. It was an environment that wasn't good for anyone. So we took off to live with my grandmother in Washington, and that's where I went to school. I didn't have a lot of my father around, but I started thinking about him a lot during that period. I certainly had resentments, as any young person does, in a situation where a parent isn't around or a family is split. But on Rooster, I was trying to think about his side of it, what he might have gone through. So again, similar to the Rodney King stuff, you know, I do have an awareness of the Vietnam War, the Vietnam conflict, but being a British man in his mid-30s, again, that experience of it, you know, I just don't have it. I guess it's hard for me to fully experience the impact that the Vietnam War had on a whole generation of Americans, not just those that served in that war, but as Jerry gives the example there, you know, kind of their children and their families too.
Well, it's just powerful time in our history as well. You know, the Vietnam War went on forever. And, you know, even just looking back at like John Lennon and all the stuff going on then, people standing up against war and trying to, you know, that whole time frame is just so bad, you know, horrible, horrible time. And, you know, you don't think about the repercussions from all that stuff. You know, later on in life, you get older. Like I have, my father-in-law is, he was in Vietnam, and you know, I have some family members too that served, and, you know, some of them are never going to be the same from that. So, you know, I can't imagine having a father doing that. You're away from home, or he's away from home, and you're just kind of struggling with that, you know, somebody serving your country. My dad, I don't see them. That's got to be a weird emotional thing to deal with for him. And this song, another one that just, it's just nothing like it.
and I guess you've put it perfectly there as to why this song would resonate with so many kind of American families, because it's not, you know, it's not a song about the Vietnam War. It's about that father-son relationship and that dynamic that was affected by Jerry Sr. and his experiences of Vietnam and then the impact that had on the family.
Yeah. And this song, like, my dad wasn't around either. Mm. So my dad was locked up, and well, that's for another podcast day. But you know what I mean? Just some stuff I could definitely relate. Now, my dad didn't serve or anything like that. It wasn't like that. But it's just the content, the subject matter.
Yeah.
That song, you know, it just kind of, you could just hear it. You know, it's just so beautifully, beautiful pain. You know, it's what I call it, because it's what it is, you know. Yeah, just incredible tune, man. I remember hearing this one for the first time and getting chills. Same thing with Down in a Hole. I remember first time ever hearing these songs, and your hair stands up. You're like, what is this? And I had that with Pink Floyd too and Metallica when I was young. But it's just certain things like that. And it's just like, man, it's very impactful. And this is definitely one of those songs. I know now people make jokes because it's been played and, you know, it's been in movies and stuff like that. So, but it's just one of them songs. It's powerful, and it's still powerful to this day. Every time I hear it, I don't listen to the radio much now, but, you know, when I hear this song, it gets me, because I haven't heard it in a while, and you hear it again.
Yeah.
It's just great.
I mean, Classic Rock Review, they say Rooster is the most purely alternative and perhaps the strongest overall song on the album. I mean, obviously, as you said, you know, we've all got our favorites, and you might not be able to definitively be like, that's my favorite, but would you agree that it is one of the strongest on the album?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful song. I mean, it's just beautiful. Yeah. The high harmonies, the O's, and all the... It's just such a unique monster. It's a beautiful, beautiful song, for sure.
I mean, from what I can gather now, kind of obviously fast forward in, you know, 30 years since this album came out, that, you know, now, obviously, I've heard that Jerry sometimes brings his dad out on stage before they perform Rooster, but there was obviously a time where... Obviously, he was to hear it for the first time and to hear it played for the first time. And Jerry, in an interview in 1992, said he's only seen us play once at the time. That was, of course. And I played this song for him when we were in this club opening for Iggy Pop. I'll never forget it. He was standing in the back and he heard all the words. Of course, I was never in Vietnam and he won't talk about it. But when I wrote this, it felt right. Like these were the things he might have felt or thought. And I remember when we played it, he was back by the soundboard and I could see him. He was back there with his big gray Stetson and his cowboy boots. He's a total Oklahoma man. And at the end, he took his hat off and just held it in the air. And he was crying the whole time. This song means a lot to me. And I think, again,
it's amazing.
Yeah, just to get that, to hear that experience of what it was like for, I guess, for both of them in that moment.
I think it's amazing that he got to share that moment with his dad.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of move past and write a song where it's kind of, you know, it's just an impactful thing, probably in their relationship too. I mean, it's just something that affected their lives, and it, I mean, what a moment! Can you imagine? You know, yeah. It's so cool.
I mean, as a single, and I think it's again because of that resonance and just the kind of song it is. It reached number 7 on the US Billboard Hot 100. Over time, it's been celebrated as one of the greatest Alice in Chains songs. Metal Hammer ranked it number 12 on its list of the 100 best metal songs of the 90s. American Songwriter ranked the song at number 1 on its top 10 Alice in Chains songs earlier this year. Why do you feel that, obviously, like I say, 30 years on, why do you think this song's continuing to resonate in the way that it is?
It's just an impactful song, subject matter. There's so many people that can relate to it, and it's just put in a beautiful, perfect way. It's an iconic song. It really is. It's awesome.
So we'll move into kind of, like, I guess on sort of like vinyl editions, this would be kind of the start of side two. And this is where we start to kind of approach these songs that appear to chronicle kind of Lane's addiction to heroin. So the first one is his Junkhead. I'd say the next four or five tracks all sit quite comfortably within this theme. And Lane went as far as to say in an interview with Meat Magazine, The Dirt, and perhaps this song specifically, chronicled the whole story of the last 3 years of my life. So with what we've discussed with kind of addition to the album, moving the track list around, do you think it's been an intentional decision, again, talking about the sequence of albums and all this sort of thing, to keep the next four or five tracks together to tell a story and to make a statement?
Yeah, you would think so. Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, some of Mistaken Junkhead and a couple of other songs on the album for glamorizing heroin and hard drugs. When in fact, as we said earlier, it sounds like it's Lane just kind of processing his addiction while very much deep in the throes of it as well. And that's not necessarily something your average listener, like I've never so much as kind of smoked weed or anything. I've never touched drugs, but you know, that's not going to stop me appreciating the album and this album being a huge success. How do you think that they've been able to take such a, frankly, like a really dark subject matter and something so personal and so raw and create music that, you know, is connected as strongly as it has, that we're talking about it on a podcast about classic albums?
It's because it's real. Hmm. It's real. And that's it. People like real, especially nowadays. So this song, like, it's real. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, if you haven't done those things or experienced that stuff, you know, like it's, you're just in a weird mental space. And when you write songs like this, it's kind of sarcasm and it's got that vibe to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Lane is just so brilliant because, you know, it's like sarcastic. You know, he knows what he's doing. You know, it's just real. It's authentic. And it's just, like you said before, he just bears a soul with his drugs on this stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting because listening to some of these songs, you kind of see where he's at in his headspace. Like as the songs kind of change and what we're doing, whether it's riffy or more chill, you know, you can kind of hear that with Lane too. You can hear him, the ebbs and flows a bit, you know, kind of where he's at mentally in the headspace. It's just, it's weird.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of Junkhead, so obviously with you saying that, where is he on this song? Like where do you feel he's at this point?
I think he's high as fuck at this point, probably. You know, I mean, this is that kind of song mm-hmm. that just gives me that vibe that this was written probably feeling pretty good, if you know what I mean. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
I mean, song facts make a really interesting parallel, noting that the sentiments in Junkhead are similar to those expressed in Trainspotting. So either the Irvine Welsh novel published in 93 or, of course, the movie that was released in 96. This association is relevant because it highlights a running theme of the 90s zeitgeist, which was the notion that modern life was meaningless, dull, and defined by mass mindless conformity. The notion that heroin addiction was a romantic alternative to that was not uncommon at that time. 1990s books, movies, and music frequently portrayed that alternative. So, I mean, I don't know if you've read Trainspotting or you've seen the movie, but that parallel really helped me to understand this song a lot more. That, you know, like I say, very much, I mean, I think heroin was very, for lack of a better word, kind of in vogue at the time, and it was seen as a romantic alternative, like you say, to kind of, oh well, life's shit, life's boring, this is going to spice it up. And I guess it was a really interesting parallel to think about, obviously, the cautionary tale of Trainspotting and then thinking about this song and kind of sort of marrying the two together.
Yeah, life's boring or life's scary as shit, and sometimes you don't want to feel things.
Yeah,
and that's what I think this song is. You know what I mean? This is one of the moments you can just kind of, the vibe it gives me is, you know, gone on a journey and wrote this one probably.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. This one's just kind of different, isn't it? It's just got a different, the feel to this song is anger, sarcasm. You know, it's just a weird song, is always weird, but I love this song. I really do. I think it's cool. Yeah. Just, it's a unique one.
Mm-hmm. But then we move on to the title track. It's The Dirt. Yep. So this has been implied with kind of interviews and stuff, but never definitely confirmed. The Dirt is about Lane's fiance at the time, Demri Parrott, who many believe introduced Lane to heroin. So again, I'm not going to make that say like, oh, this is just kind of assumption and hearsay and stuff. But if we for a moment assume that's true, and I'm very much a painter to say that that's not confirmed, does it make sense that this would be the title track for the album, that a lot of the things we're exploring around addiction and heroin a song about the person that potentially introduced him to that world would be kind of the name of the album.
Yeah, makes sense. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And this is another song that I love. Mm. This is, for this record, this is up there for me. I just love, I've always loved this song. Really do. So yes, that makes sense though, what you said. Yeah.
So what is it about Dirt that kind of makes it a highlight for you?
A melody. I'm a singer, man. So it's just the melodies. The melodies are amazing in the song. And that's, they're just, again, the layers of harmonies and the melodies and where it takes you. And it's just such a cool, kind of gritty, grinding song. And I just always loved it. It's just always been, you know, you hear all the stuff on the radio, but this is one of those songs that would never be on the radio. And I always loved it. Definitely. One of my favorites on the record, for real.
I think there's something to that as well, isn't there? That, you know, particularly if it's a band you really love and an album you really love, I think sometimes you do drift towards those album tracks because they're not the ones you're going to hear on the radio. They're not the ones that, they're not the ones that they're necessarily going to play live. And if they do, you're going to lose your mind. Like, you know, and like I've got them with, you know, a lot of the bands I love, like Queen and Metallica and that, like that. It's not necessarily the hits. I mean, obviously I do love a lot of them, but it's not necessarily the hits that I love. It is those deeper cuts. And this seems like a good example of that for you.
Absolutely, for sure. That's a great way to put it.
I mean, the lyrics, they very clearly reference kind of like suicidal ideation. So perhaps as a consequence.
But we talk about mental health all the time. And this isn't a new problem. You know, this is stuff that's been around for ages. And it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you do, how much money you make. Everybody deals with things up here. And it's just, that's why I love music so much. Because this stuff keeps coming out. It's just humanity, being a person. Trying to fit in, we're all just spinning around the sun together, try to get along, you know?
And I think what I like about, well, to be fair, you could say it for the whole album, let alone this song, but it's that raw, unflinching honesty that feels directly at odds with like what else was, obviously, I mean, yeah, grunge was coming through, but what else was kind of on the radio, what else was on MTV at the time? Because it was, you know, your Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, you know, Life's a Party, All rock and roll all night, for lack of a better way of putting it, to kind of reference Kiss for a moment, you know, very much at odds with that. Do you think that was a huge part of the success of Alice in Chains, particularly in that breakthrough where they were like, well, hang on, actually, you know, life can be pretty shit sometimes. And that's that honesty and grittiness that people could connect with.
Again, I think it's real. Mm. It's just, it's, you know, you come off of, and there's nothing against Bon Jovi. I know there's people out there, oh, big glam rock. They were all amazing.
Yeah,
they did. Whatever. I don't care what anybody says. Fantastic songwriters, incredibly talented. But it's just, it was all just kind of, you get to a point where that stuff, you know, you want something that's real and authentic and a little bit more of that instead of, there's nothing wrong with going to a show and having fun, but there's people out there that like the real shit too, you know what I mean? And I think that was a band that came across at a great time. You know, look at what they brought. It's just so different. And yeah, definitely got a lot of ears, as it should.
And of course, with it being the title track, Lane revealed that the song inspired the album's artwork. So he told Meat Magazine, he said, the album cover, I like to refer to it as revenge. The song Dirt was written to a certain person who basically buried my ass. So the woman on the album cover is kind of the portrayal of that person being sucked down into the dirt instead of me. Yeah. The picture is the spitting image of her, and that wasn't even planned. I was pretty angry about it when I first saw it. She's not happy about it either. It was really eerie. And interestingly, I think I'd read that the reason she was so upset, so for anyone kind of reading between the lines there, you know, that is Demery that he's talking about. And that the model that they got for the album cover apparently looked very much like her. And I think from what I've read, I think it was more she was unhappy that they just didn't hire her for the job. I think she kind of liked the idea of being on an album cover rather than it being someone else. I mean, what do you make of that cover? I mean, I think with that context, and I mean this, I don't mean this as a negative, it makes the song that much more unsettling, which makes it that much more of a listen.
I think it's a powerful cover. It's one of my favorite covers ever. I own this t-shirt when I was really young. I coming home and my mom was like, what is that? I was like, this is the Alice, you know what I mean? But it's just, I just remember seeing the album cover and it was just, it's so cool. It's just so different, so unique. And I know they, I was reading an article about how they shot it and stuff like that. I think it was like, I thought somebody said it was discussed as a joke though, that she was going to be in it. I read that somewhere. Yeah. So I don't know, who knows, but it's just interesting, you know, and then having that just fits the record so great. Not only the dirt, but the cover and just how they did it. I think it's just beautiful. It's just so cool, you know? That simple image can talk about death, relationships, addiction. It's just such a powerful image to me. Yeah, so.
So we'll move in to Godsmack now, a slang term for heroin overdose. Godsmack continues that addiction concept that's dominated side two. Heavy Metal Overload has some criticism for this one, saying it's got the woozy, sick Lane Staley vocals and an upbeat, wah-drenched chorus, but musically, it's one of the album's least remarkable tracks. Is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah, this isn't one of my favorite songs either. So, yeah, there's just a couple on here that I didn't like as much as the others. Comparing it to these songs that are on this record, because again, you know, it's not like they're horrible songs or anything. It's just when you're hearing this stuff from Alice in Chains and you hit a certain gear, and I think it's like that with a lot of bands. Not every song is going to be the best song you've ever written, and I think people have a hard time with that. You know, like you said earlier, there's going to be songs that are left over, and there's things that you go through, and it's just one of those songs, you know. I think that's fair criticism. And if you ask Jerry Cantrell, I mean, he's probably going to say, yeah, there's some songs, you know, you listen back. I mean, I think everybody's like that, you know.
Yeah. I mean, Classic Rock Review, they take issue. We've talked a lot about how the second half of the album is very much kind of almost like a mini concept album in itself, if you like. Yeah. Classic Rock Review take issue with that, which we'll talk about soon. However, one thing they do say is they say that Godsmack does redeem itself partially by actually celebrating the joys of heroin abuse and stepping away from the doom and gloom for one song. I don't know if it's just kind of the wording of that, because I wouldn't say any of the songs kind of glamorize heroin use, but do you think it is more about, I'm trying to think how you put it when we were talking about Junkhead, like, you know, the, you know, maybe this is one kind of written about the where you know, perhaps when he was under the influence and was feeling good.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the review stuff and all that, who gives a shit? You know what I mean? It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, whatever, you know, the dude's writing songs that are still incredible for most people, you know, and he's going and doing things that he shouldn't be doing. And there's going to be songs like that come out that are just gnarly. And that's what it is. It's just kind of a different, when I hear that kind of stuff from Lane and just being a huge fan of this band and just understanding, you know, some stuff about addiction, definitely not that, but you know, you can kind of hear where they're probably not at their best, not feeling the best. They're maybe mentally messed up. And I think you hear that in some songs, and I think that's good. I think it's a good thing. You know, we can't have 13 down in the holes on an album. You know what I mean?
I mean, obviously that review I was talking about from Heavy Metal Overload, they suggest that Godsmack's more important when listened amongst the rest of the album and the songs around it. So again, that idea of like,
yeah,
the album as kind of a piece of art rather than just a selection of songs on a disc.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, they say the title and its unflinching portrayal of someone for whom heroin has become everything gives it a thematic and lyrical importance that makes it a key deep cut on the album, even if it's no great shakes when listened to in isolation. Do you think that's it? Like, you know, it's not necessarily if you were putting Alice in Chains on shuffle in your car, this might be one that you skip or that you pay less attention to, but in the context of the album, it feels like it's an important song of the journey that we go on.
Yeah, because it's important to understand Lane and understand everything to kind of understand their music, in my opinion. When you become a fan of a band, you appreciate these kind of songs more because of, mm-hmm. you know, just how you look at them. And then if you're just listening to this album for the first time, you've never heard of Alice in Chains, you know what I mean? You're not going to look at this song the same. So I think that's a, you know, a little concept album thing at the end there with this addiction stuff, I think is important that it's in order and makes sense, you know? It's cool. That's cool. It's a good way to put it.
So our next track's an interesting one. It goes by a few different names. So on some editions, it's Untitled. It's been known as kind of Intro and then in parentheses, Dream Sequence. I think the band have kind of named it a box set as Iron Gland.
Yeah.
So this is just kind of a short kind of 44 second passage with Tom Araya from Slayer on vocals. I mean, what do you make of Iron Gland? Like, do you like how brief it is, or do you feel this is something they could have beefed out a bit more and kind of gone with it?
I don't know. I never understood it, to be honest with you. This is one that I just kind of skipped past. I heard it a couple times, like, I don't get it. You know what I mean? Because I just, I don't know. It's just, it's not something that I listened to. I was just like, what's going on here? I was like, they were probably fucked up. And they were like, dude, let's do this or something. I swear there's got to be some story. There's got to be a story behind it. And I wish I knew it. So I feel like this is kind of one of them things where the guys know what was going on, but you know, other people are going to think, but I just think it's funny. But yeah, I never really got into this one.
Yeah. And I guess it's interesting because again, some editions of the album have it as a separate track. Some of them have it merged on kind of the start, almost like an intro to Hate to Feel. There's some editions that just remove it completely. So, you know, a really weird kind of, I can't think of any other track. You do often get ones where kind of they drift into each other depending on the edition. Right. I can't think of one with such a kind of varied, depending on the different editions.
Yeah.
But it sounds like to you, it feels like something very separate, even though with how short it is, rather than kind of the intro to what's to come next.
Oh, I mean, what you said, I mean, it, who knows, man? It kind of, it just feels weird to me. It always did. Like, listen to it. I was like, what's going on here? You know? I don't know.
but let's move on to Hate to Feel. Yeah. So, you know, song facts single out the lines, used to be curious, now the shit sustenance. That's the essential meaning of the song. Is in those two lines. Arguably, in some ways, maybe kind of the theme of this whole section of the album, I guess, in some ways. I mean, do you think, obviously we talked about the role that each of these songs is playing as well. Do you think that journey from Junkhead right through to Hate to Feel, how good a job has that done in taking us into this kind of steady descent into Lane's addiction or the protagonist's addiction if he's kind of taking liberties with it, perhaps?
Well, it makes a lot of sense, and I think it's just the journey. You know, you do the things he's doing not to feel, and then to do the other thing that you have to feel good about, you have to do the other thing, and it's just that's this vicious cycle, you know. And I think it just kind of, you kind of see that evolving throughout these songs, and who likes to feel, you know, pain. And there's, I think we all hate to feel sometimes.
And I mean, all music said, Hate to Feel shows Alice in Chains in woozy, murkily descending riff mode. Take its time to grind down into the ground. And I almost feel like the music tells that story as well, not just the lyrics. And it's that phrase that I've really picked up, that taking its time to grind down into the ground. I think that really hit with me because musically it's very appropriate, but also lyrically, I think it is too.
Yeah. This song always gave me a vibe, you know, just like, man, you could hear the pain and agony, you know, that's what it is. It's an interesting journey, that's for sure.
I mean, Classic Rock Review, as I'd said, they take a little bit of issue with this kind of sequence of songs, the second half of the album. Before I get to that, they say that Hate to Feel almost sounds like it belongs in some kind of rock opera and briefly rips off Dazed and Confused during the middle. Is that something you'd agree with? I wasn't quite sure whether we're getting that there, but I don't know if that's anything that you could pick out from that.
I have no idea. I think people have too much time in their hands.
But again, with that kind of sequence of songs, and this is kind of what they think about it. And I guess this is kind of, there's two schools, isn't there? So obviously we've talked, you know, about what a journey this has taken us on, you know, kind of what a masterpiece this is, essentially. Classic Rock Review say, honestly, the whole junkie thing does get old when beaten to death. And it feels at times like going into the darkness is just a game to the composers. From the listener's point of view, it may get to the point of like watching a stale old movie plot reused over again. It's this bit of repetitiveness that holds the album back a step from being a full-fledged classic. So
sounds like that dude has not done heroin before. For sure. Clearly he does not get the journey that this record is on.
I guess it's funny because I'd said earlier on though, I've never, you know, obviously I think we can all relate to addiction in some way, like you say, if it's food or whatever it is.
Now look at me, dude, you know, I'm not getting any skinnier over here.
No, me neither. But I think for me, and again, obviously it's not an addiction, we've talked a lot about mental health, and I've had my experiences with poor mental health with kind of anxiety and depression and stuff. And for some reason, not that that's addiction, but a lot of that kind of journey that this album takes you on really makes me think about those times and makes me think about that. And obviously for Lane, his mental health will have been a huge part of that addiction. So I wonder if that's maybe kind of what I'm sort of picking out of that, even though I've not had that experience of taking drugs myself.
Absolutely. Mental health is it's tough, you know, because like, think about being Lane Staley and you're writing music and you're experiencing these things and people don't understand you or don't even know you. And then some dude from some magazine is trying to say a bunch of stuff about the songs you're writing and how you feel. And you know, it's kind of a weird thing, isn't it? It's just a weird thing. It's gotta be weird to be in that kind of, if you're struggling with mental health, like people's words can be powerful too. I don't think people understand that you could like have the shittiest day ever. Like imagine writing a song or he's going through an experience and he's having a hard time. You read these negative things from people all the time. And it's like, he's already just trying to live every day, you know, like getting out of bed and dealing with his own shit in his own head. You know, I just think that it's hard to, you know, the thing that I don't like to do is go talk about other bands and, you know, be negative about people's stuff, because I just think it's, you know, it's art. It's like, it's good that people do these things. Whether you like it or not, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be doing it. It's what makes them happy. You know what I mean? I just think it's like, it's just an odd thing. Sorry, I'm rambling again, dude.
No, at all, man. Don't worry.
I should have warned you about me.
It's all good.
I got problems
it's all
like
good.
To read about. I'm just kidding. All right, man. Appreciate it.
But no, I mean, we'll move on to Angry Chair now.
Ooh, yeah.
So both Hate to Feel and Angry Chair are the only two Alice in Chains songs, certainly on this album, possibly at all, written entirely by Lane with no input from Jerry, who, as we've said, very much the conceptual force in the band. Angry Chair is also the first recording where Lane plays guitar, and Jerry expressed a lot of pride at Lane's work on both these songs. Do they feel somewhat different than the other songs because they're very, like, a very individual piece of work rather than that more collaborative stuff that kind of Jerry was doing and Jerry and Lane working together?
I think Angry Chair is the weirdest, coolest song. Like, it's just, it's definitely different, I think. You can just tell it's Lane, you know, just, especially just kind of where he goes with it. To me, it's just it's different. It's just a different song. There's nothing that sounds like Angry Chair to me that I can think of off the top of my head. It's just kind of a weird tune. It's cool. And it's just dark. It's dark again. Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know. I knew he wrote that. I remember reading that. And then and you can just kind of hear the difference, you know. I can. What about you?
Yeah, I do. I think, and I think, again, it's a really positive thing. I always think it's really cool when, you know, like you say, I think, you know, Jerry was very much that conceptual force in the band. Like I'd said, I think there's a song earlier in the album which is credited to all four of them. Again, I think that's Rain When I Die. So again, very collaborative to then have these two songs on the end. We've been through this journey with Lane to then have these two songs at the end of the very him, you know what I mean? As yeah. you say, I think oh, is a really, really bold move, but it really works.
And the lyrics are interesting really to this song too, you know. I think it's an interesting song in general. It's such a unique song. Every time I listen to this record, this song is just, it's so weird, you know. It's in a good way, good weird.
Yeah. And I think part of that which makes it work, and I think this is great, obviously in the book Alice in Chains, The Untold Story, engineer Brian Karlstrom reveals that he layered 16 tracks of vocals for the song, all different harmonies and multiple layers of harmony. So obviously in this day and age, that's easy as to do. You know, I could do that with this podcast if I wanted to
in a few
minutes. We should do that. But like, obviously in 1992, that'll have been much more difficult than it would be to do today. So that must have been a real undertaking. It makes me think of like Bohemian Rhapsody when they were doing so many layers that the tape was going thin and all of this kind of stuff.
Love that song so much. Anyways, that's one of my favorite songs of all time, by the way.
Yeah.
Ever.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think, again, it must have been a huge undertaking. Even, I say just 16 tracks, you know what I mean? Like yeah. even that, you know, it must have been a hell of a job for Brian and the band to kind of get that together.
I can imagine. Yes. Yeah.
So a mild bit of criticism, which I sense from our conversation, you're probably going to disagree with. So again, Dead End Follies review. Dead End, to be fair though, Dead End Follies review is very very positive. But one thing they have said is they say Angry Chair is a fine song in itself, but cannot hold a candle to some of the bolder ballads like Rooster or Down in a Hole.
And that's fair.
Do you think that's...
Yeah, it's like Angry Chair is still a cool song and it's dope in its own way. Because it's not like Rooster and it's not like other songs. Rooster's Rooster. It's an iconic song. You know, I mean, it's just, and that's good. Yeah, I mean, Rooster's one of those songs that's impactful, but Angry Chair is just different. You know, it's just, it's Lane being Lane and doing his thing, and I think that's cool too. You know, but it's fair criticism what they said for sure, for comparing it all like a contest or something.
So our final track on the album is Wood, also the first single released from Dirt. It was written in tribute to Andrew Wood, the lead singer of Mother Love Bone, who passed away from a heroin overdose in 1990. So Jerry explained in 2017, a really significant thing for all of us was kind of a heavier foreshadowing of some things that would directly affect us and our friends was the death of Andy Wood. that song was me thinking about him like we all did and trying to put that down and just kind of write a little ode for him because he wasn't there and everything was taken off. It was a nice thing to be able to use that song. It was very poignant, I thought, because we kind of carried him with us. And I think, you know, when we've talked about grunge albums before, my classic album, I'm sure Andrew's come up before, possibly on the Soundgarden episode because he lived with Chris Cornell. You know, it makes you wonder what could have been if Andrew had lived to see this kind of explosion of grunge into the mainstream and how successful Mother Love Bone potentially could have been.
Mother Love Bone, I think, would have been huge. And Andrew Wood was a hell of a singer and a hell of a frontman, too. I've watched pretty much everything that you can watch with him. And, you know, incredible singer. Yeah, he was headed for superstardom, you know. And it's so sad to see somebody like that, again, dealing with addiction. And it's even more sad to have a band like Alice in Chains and Lane and Jerry watch, you know, him die and then get into it anyways. And that's the sad thing about all that stuff. It's like, man, it's so sad. You know, it's just horrible to lose people that can make an impact in a lot of people's lives in a good way. And he's so young, and it's a bummer, man.
I mean, Dead End Follies, they believe the album saves the best for last. So they say perhaps the best song and dirtiest song on Dirt is the closer Wood. Led by a thudding mid-tempo bass line and reverberating guitars, Wood creates an atmosphere of frustration and regret before Lane Staley even takes the microphone. Originally a song about the passing of Mother Love Bone singer Andrew Wood, it has since become an anthem to bad life decisions and the strange sense of comfort of self-destructive patterns. It's a truly powerful song, but it's not a happy one. It's a song to either wallow in your misery or to energize yourself to and bust out of a bad situation. Do you think that's why the song has so much appeal? Because again, a lot of the people listening to this album may not have had those experiences that the likes of Andrew and the band had. But is there kind of a greater meaning that people can pull out of it?
Yeah, this is another one I think can mean different things to you. This is a powerful chorus. I remember, this is another song I think is amazing. And I remember, you know, because the verses are eerie and they kind of capture you in the moment. That the chorus to this song is incredible and it's so powerful. Yeah, it's a great tune, man. But yeah, this one's I think a multiple meaning one too, for sure.
I mean, Rolling Stone, at the end of the decade, they lauded the song, saying a Seattle song that in 1999 evokes no grunge nostalgia. It's timeless, one of the most stylish singles of the decade. The work of a band which understands that life gets way out of hand, but the first-rate rock recordings can't. I mean, more praise, Paste magazine named it the third best grunge song of all time in 2014. I mean, how important is Wood? I mean, to be fair, I think what Rolling Stone is saying there, and to extend Paste magazine with ranking itself high, is that this is a song that kind of transcends grunge. Would that be kind of fair to say?
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's their opinion. You know, I think it's a great song. You know, I'm not cool enough to make those things, but you know what I mean? It's a badass song. It's just so different. Again, it's so eerie but powerful. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of them songs that makes you stop in your tracks when you hear it, especially for the first time. If you're hearing the song, it's a very powerful tune. Yeah, I mean, it's badass.
In terms of it, kind of within the album, how does Wood end the album for you? So, you know, where are you when we get to the end of this track in this album?
I want more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I always get with Alice in Chains, you know? I want to hear more of it.
Yeah.
It is. It's just what a journey. I mean, it's just a hell of a journey. That whole record's so awesome. And it just ends in a powerful tune. And again, one of their best ever songs. Just right in your face. That's the left hook. They open with the right hook. And then they finish you off with the left. Yeah, it's awesome ending, I think.
I mean, alongside the likes of Nevermind, Super Unknown, 10... Dirt stands as a testament to the power and dominance of grunge in the early 90s. Yet, as Rolling Stone said, it doesn't sound dated. There's no kind of like nostalgic quality to it. It's just kind of as real as it's always been. Alice Patillo at Metal Hammer wrote this really awesome piece about how important this album was to her, and she sums up the impact of the album perfectly. So she says, "A majority of Dirt's listeners likely won't be able to relate to what life as a struggling addict is like, but the incredible blend of misery and aggression within Jerry Cantrell's somber brooding vocals, the way they work in harmony with Lane's anguished wails and the sludgy, distorted guitar tones make it a cathartic experience, not just for the band, but for listeners. Whether you're a metalhead or not, Dirt is a masterpiece so honest and raw, you can't help but be drawn in and made to feel something. Dirt might have a grimy exterior, but delve inside and it's pure gold." So obviously high praise.
That's
there.
Beautifully written. Well, that's a great way to put it though.
Yeah. I mean,
whoever wrote that gets it.
Yeah. I mean, with all of that in mind, why has this album stood the test of time?
I think it's the, it's just, there's nothing like it. It's just, it's a record that is so amazing. So many great songs on it. I mean, I don't know how many singles this had on it that were on the radio, but five probably, four,
I think
five,
it is five,
like
yeah.
That. I mean, that alone is tough. And then being in a genre that was new and kind of a thing that people didn't understand and kind of crossing the metal and, you know, singing too, just beautiful stuff altogether. Yeah, it's just crazy, man. Powerful stuff, for sure.
And finally, why is Dirt your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
I think Dirt is something you, if you've never heard it, do yourself a favor. If you love Alice in Chains or just love music in general, it doesn't really matter. For me personally, this always was just, I grew up, you know, like I talked about my dad earlier and stuff like that. It's a powerful record for just being a human being. You're struggling with addiction, struggling with pain and agony. Like you said, there's songs about girlfriend in it. It's just a lot of life, you know, and it was just an important record for me growing up. And I encourage you to go check it out.
Well, Terry, thank you very much for joining me. It's been great to kind of dive into the Dirt, as it were, with Alice in Chains. I mean, obviously, you talked a little bit about Revolution that came out earlier this year. What are the plans for Deep Fall kind of over the rest of 2022?
So right now, we actually have a show this weekend in Michigan. We're going to be playing a Smiling Acres Festival there. And then we're in the process of writing more right now. And then we're going to be releasing an EP at the end of summer. We don't have a date yet, but it's going to be end of summer, early fall, and it'll come out everywhere. So, but it's been a pleasure meeting you, man. Thank you so much for having me on. It was nice talking to you about Alice in Chains and Dirt. It was fun.
A massive thanks to Terry for joining me to chat all about this fantastic album, Dirt by Alice in Chains. And I think, you know, yeah, it's obviously very heavy subject matter. And I think I had a bit of a disclaimer there that, you know, if people were finding that a bit too heavy, if, you know, it was kind of sort of touching certain people's buttons, you know, take a step away, take a moment, all that kind of thing. But at the same time, I like to think that me and Terry hopefully kept it a little bit light as well. It was a joy to chat with, a great choice of a classic album as well. And, you know, thank you very much for coming on the show. But that'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me. Don't forget that over the next two episodes, I'm going to be joined by members of Sixth Sense. Fantastic new metal band just coming through. Also, the lead singer of Stuck Mojo, Robbie J. Fonts. He'll be joining me in a couple of weeks' time to talk about Slipknot's debut album. And vocalist of The Agonist, Vicky Sarekis, will be joining me in 4 weeks' time to chat all about Evanescence's Fallen album. So some great episodes to come, maybe moving a little bit closer to those modern classic albums, the likes of Hybrid Theory and Blink-182's self-titled album, the kind that we've done recently, The Black Parade, another one. So it's great when we're kind of looking at these more modern ones and kind of reinterpreting them as classic albums. But absolutely, really excited to get stuck into those. So please join me for some fantastic episodes across August and September, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers!